In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is First to Know the Nature of Things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I asked the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think, I know.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
Fair shake of a sauce bottle,
mate. G'day there and thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of ANU's Democracy Sausage. I'm Mark Kenny and it's welcome back also to my friend and colleague, Professor Paul Pickering. Paul, I really enjoyed our chat last week with Professor Dennis Quinn from Georgetown University. He was discussing American politics, his prediction that Joe Biden would probably win on the basis of his modelling, his economic modelling, probably win the popular vote, the college a portion of voting, of course, is much harder to predict. But it was really interesting chat, I thought, just hearing about some of these issues that are in play. We know about Joe Biden's age, for example, how that interacts with Kamala Harris's apparent unpopularity and has a number of people wondering, you know, is Biden too old? And if he's anything near too old, is he likely to perhaps not make it through a whole term? And if he doesn't, does that mean the VP comes in? And therefore, is the VP considered an acceptable candidate for president? All these sorts of issues. So it was a really interesting discussion and we got some good feedback about it.
Yeah, I think it's really worth people going back and listening to that podcast, I guess for a couple of reasons. One is that a reminder for people of the difference between the popular vote and the electoral college.
Yeah, because of course, I mean, Trump actually lost the popular vote in 2016 and won the election.
Yeah, and Dennis was making it clear that his modelling was showing that it's exactly the same seats in the electoral college which are going to make the difference.
Yeah.
The bit that he, you know, was really revealing was showing that it's those seats in particular which haven't benefited as much from the health of the American economy.
Yeah.
And so that may also have an impact. It was also really interesting, I think, for him to walk us through the model whereby another candidate for the Democratic Party could emerge.
Mm.
You know, that was a real revelation about how Biden accepting the nomination and then standing down meant that the floor was open for other nominations.
Yeah.
And I think that's really worth finding more about.
Well, it is, because it's the kind of narrow path to a change from Joe Biden to another candidate that, and let's be blunt about it, that does not involve the VP stepping up automatically. And that's actually the point that some Democrats are thinking, could that be the way we end up taking a different candidate to the election to take on Donald Trump? I think what we're talking about here is, even from Dennis's calculations, a pretty low likelihood contingency. But nonetheless, as you say, it's one of those models where rather than Biden stepping down as the endorsed candidate, having accepted the endorsement officially, he would step aside and the VP wouldn't automatically set up and then it could be Gavin Newsom or Gretchen Whitmer, I think her name is.
Yeah, I think it's Whittier. But yeah, and in a way it's a really good introduction for today's conversation, because actually it's an indication of the way which, in a sense, politics with which we are greatly familiar can change. And that is comparable to what we've been seeing,
yeah,
certainly since the late 2000s.
Yeah, quite dramatic changes in politics and the sort of
our expectations of how politics is going to turn out.
The topography of it. So, and of course, we have an election looming ourselves, either at the end of this year or in the early part of next year. The last election saw what can accurately be described as a step change occur when six Heartland Liberal seats were won by community independents. Those names are pretty well known, of course: Allegra Spender, Monique Ryan, Kylie Tink, Sophie Scomps, Kate Chaney, and Zoe Daniel. In my view, these are among the really the top tier of MPs in the Parliament at the moment, both in their effectiveness as candidates, which they were successful, so that's a pretty strong indicator of their effectiveness anyway, but also as MPs. And it really does feel like it was a moment where the grip of the major party duopoly was significantly and perhaps structurally loosened. We'll know about more about that over time. But one who showed the way all the way in this, who was ahead of the game, who did all that and more a whole election cycle before the Teals came in, when she tipped no less than the former PM, Tony Abbott, out of his sinecure in Warringah on Sydney's North Shore, was Zali Steggall. And I'm delighted to welcome Zali Steggall. Overdue appearance on Democracy Sausage, Zali, and it's great to have you here in the studio.
Oh, thank you. Great to be here.
Now, before we get on to some of these issues we've sort of touched on there and some more detail, I suppose, there'll be plenty of your electors who'll know your story and many others, but I wonder if we could just talk about your somewhat unorthodox path to politics. Malcolm Turnbull used to make the point, still was only a couple of weeks ago, I think, making the point that he came to politics when he was 50. And so he was really saying, I was a fully formed person doing many other things. This is actually true, not necessarily the age part of it, but it is very much true of all of your closest.
It's getting close.
Spoiler alert, April.
That's still young for a politician.
It is still young for a politician, but it's relatively late for a candidate. And it's probably a good thing in a number of ways. This is what Turnbull was saying. And I think whilst the Teals as a group, of which, as I say, you would be the sort of the forerunner, the groundbreaker there, probably none of them are in the 50-year ranges from like just a sort of quick mental calculation now. But what is common about them is that they're all people who have done quite significant things, achieved a lot in professions they've been involved with, made big contributions, and have then turned to politics, concerned at the direction of things. So tell us about your particular path. It's a good one.
Yeah, I mean, I think first, also on that question, we've seen an interesting development, I think, over the last 20 years of this idea that politics is a career choice. And so it's a pathway to politics within the major parties where they start out as advisors, or maybe they're, you know, at university, they're the presidents of the Young Liberals or the Young Labor, and they work their way through the system. They've generally had very little career experience outside of that political, very narrow political silo. And so they've, I think, views and willingness to embrace debate, look outside ideology for merits around policy areas is quite limited. And so I think that's left us with a situation with politically a pretty, a very uninspiring landscape.
It can be a bit narrow, can't it?
It's too narrow. Mm. And I think that's probably where I generated from. And the fact that, like my fellow independents, Teals, if you want to call us that, we are changing that
mold. Well, I think you started
that,
didn't you? It was your colour.
You can call me an OG. I'm the original. That's all right.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
So my pathway to politics was, I was a professional skier, alpine skier. Not your usual sport for the northern beaches of Sydney.
No.
Spent some formative years in France in the French Alps, went to 4 Winter Olympics for Australia, made Australian history by winning the first independent individual medal at the Winter Olympics in a field and a sport that was pretty competitive. Alpine skiing is hard to achieve. So I guess that would say for me, I'm not afraid of a challenge, and I'm not afraid of going against the trend, in the sense that, you know, Australia in the 90s was very focused on summer sports, especially in the lead up to the Sydney Olympics. Mm. And yet I won a bronze medal in 1998 at the Winter Olympics, right? And that set Australia on a pathway for much better results in winter sports as well. So that's exciting. So I guess I was a little bit groundbreaking in that career path. I then went on to study law, and I practiced as a barrister at the New South Wales Bar for a bit over 10 years. years while I had kids and juggled the whole aspect of being a professional woman. And through those years, I had a growing sense of disquiet around how Australian politics was evolving. Our local representation in Warringah since Tony Abbott had been the member since 1994. And so that was pretty much from when I came of age to voting age. I had never had the opportunity to be represented federally by anyone other than Tony. And as a professional woman, I was more and more aware of how patriarchal many systems are, especially when I look at the bar and our courts and then the legal system. And then even from on boards positions, looking at how slowly gender equity was really progressing in Australia. You then overlay onto that the events from how Julia Gillard was treated in 2013 in terms of the misogyny and the clear gender inequality that we saw in the first female prime minister and how she was treated. I then go to, I think, you know, the positions Tony Abbott had on climate change and his type of leadership, which was very adversarial, very negative, to the events of Malcolm Turnbull being ousted from leadership, Julie Bishop not even being considered by the Liberal Party for leadership. I thought that was very misogynistic as well. I then even look to the US election of Trump versus Hillary Clinton, where again, a very qualified and capable female candidate overlooked for a unqualified incapable candidate. And so that really led me as a professional woman to decide in 2018 that rather than, you know, yelling at the TV in frustration, as a professional, mature woman with runs on the board when it comes to sport and a professional legal career, if I wasn't prepared to step up and offer an alternative choice to my community, then I really couldn't rail against the system. So there was a lot of grumblings in Warringah and a willingness to embrace, to look at independent representation. Local government level had independent mayors. We had had independent state members. So there was clearly an appetite if the right candidate was there. And I think like all communities, Warringah is fairly maybe, you know, parochial in that we want one of our own. You can't fly in a candidate. It has to be someone born in, you know, true blue Northern Beaches local and someone that represents, I think, the values and the aspirations of the community. And that was around issues of gender equality and integrity and inclusion and around policy and really looking at merit-based and fact-based policy, especially around climate change. So we have a community that is very focused on what are the challenges future generations are going to face, what is our legacy. And there was a deep dissatisfaction with Tony Abbott's representation, especially if you go back and think of the marriage plebiscite, for example. I think Warringah had the third highest vote for the plebiscite, and yet he walked out of the chamber and didn't reflect that vote.
Yeah, I mean, that was something I noticed at the time as well. I mean, you could not be more out of step with your electorate. The electorate was, I think it was actually second behind Wentworth in terms of the Liberal seats and in terms of the yes vote, the support in that plebiscite. And as you say, Abbott was probably the most vocal, the most senior no campaigner in the country.
Yeah.
Right there, you could just see this massive disconnect between the kind of representation he was giving to the electors of Warringah. That said, independent candidates have bobbed up at elections since time immemorial. I mean, there are just about always someone on the ticket in most seats that is running that's not from the major parties that's arguing a kind of an independent thing. But, you know, you achieved something quite significant there.
Well, I like to think that I took the sporting approach to it. So we've seen, you know, Cathy McGowan in 2013 in Indi. We've seen Rob Oakeshott and Tony Windsor. We've seen other independents get up. We had seen Karen Phelps get up at the by-election in Wentworth, and I think that was very instrumental because it showed a traditional liberal conservative seat but with progressive social values was looking for something different to where the current Liberal Party was that from a policy perspective? I also very much looked at it. I wasn't interested, and I don't mean this in any disrespect. I did not want a dinky die community campaign where we're doing it by the smell of an oily rag, you know, on the couch out the back of the garage. For me, this was a professional campaign. As an Olympic athlete, you don't go into an event half cooked, half prepared without the right coaching. I'm in it to win it. And this is a race where there is no prize for second place, right? No. The winner takes all.
Yeah.
You have 4 months to launch, you know, if you think of a candidate as a product, you have 4 months to launch to the market, to establish yourself in the market and win the market. Mm. So you have to be prepared. So from my point of view, I think there are three key elements you need. You need the tribe. So you need the people on the ground, the community support, the willingness to look for change, for look for different. You need the people to wear the t-shirts, right? You need people on the ground and local people. You do need the professional. So the fundraising was incredibly important to enable me to pay for professionals, you know, when it comes to building websites, you know, your branding, your campaign, putting messaging out.
You were very successful at fundraising, weren't you?
And look, I don't think it hurts that Warringah is the second most affluent electorate in the country, but
and Wentworth is the first.
And Wentworth is the first. So yes. But again, it shows that community was looking for something different and very much got behind this new model, this new opportunity. And I had great support. The vast majority of my funding came from the electorate. So that does say a lot. And it enabled us to, you know, have the level of professionalism necessary to run a well-run campaign, resourced with a campaign office and all those things that are necessary. And then, of course, you need the candidate, right? You need that local person that people will trust to reflect their values and position on issues and approach things in that sensible way. So it was, I think, groundbreaking as a campaign in the sense we showed that in a urban environment where traditionally major parties have a stranglehold at this level of politics, where it is expensive to run a successful campaign, it could be done. And what we saw, and I should say, I had amazing support from all over the country. People felt very engaged with the contest of Tony Abbott versus me. Yes, there were a lot of people fairly vested.
Absolutely.
I still, when I'm at airports and around the country, I still get people who will randomly come up to me and say thank you. So there was definitely a national sense of willingness to see change. But also it created a blueprint, and we were very open with other community groups in neighbouring seats, for example, McKellar and North Sydney. You know, I don't think it's a coincidence that so many of my neighbouring seats went independent at the 2022 election, because our communities are, you know, we have shared communities of interest. We have a lot of interaction amongst
people.
All of,
people shop in each other's electorates and work in each other's electorates.
There's Sydney, North Shore, and even with Wentworth. And so you can't be what you can't see. And so once communities saw that different representation was possible, that with the right approach, a campaign can be successful, that these are the key ingredients you need to give a campaign the best chance of success, I think that's how you saw the growth in 2022.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? That assumption that had prevailed up until then, that there was something honourable about a genuinely local campaign that was, as you say, kind of run out of the back of someone's house or whatever. And, you know, it's a nice romantic idea, but you're up against professional outfits that don't give up political power easily.
I compare it to the old, you know, if you think about the old fight between amateur versus professional standing at the Olympic Games, right? There was this very romanticized or nostalgic idea that you should stay an amateur athlete to go to the Olympic Games, which meant you couldn't pay for a coach. You couldn't have a professional, you know, you had to work and train in your spare time.
And if you were wealthy, you started out with a big
advantage.
And if
you were wealthy, you could afford to do it, which was, so it was very, you know, exclusionary as an approach. But the reality was, if you want to be the best, you've got to be prepared to be coached. You've got to be prepared to train full time. You know, all those things that make you succeed in sport, I think are very true for the arena of politics. And so That professional approach to the campaign was incredibly important.
Just staying with that arena of sport and politics for a second, this is probably a cheap shot, but let's be specific. The independent medal that you achieved in Nagano was?
Bronze medal in the slalom.
I mean, I was going to make a perhaps not particularly witty link between downhill slalom racing and politics and see whether there's any significant...
What are the correlations? Look, I guess the only thing I would say, anyone that knows alpine skiing, it's quite a blue ribbon sport of the Winter Olympics. It's heavily contested by traditional countries like Switzerland and Austria. They don't give up those spots easily. Australia, whilst we've got an admirable tradition in winter sports and we'd had champions before that, we hadn't cracked individual medals at Olympic sports. You know, it was a blue ribbon event, you know, to crack through with that bronze medal, and I backed it up with the gold medal at the World Championships a year after. It was groundbreaking from an Australian sporting history point of view and allowed for more funding to go into winter sports, which then led to we've had fantastic results since and successive, successful campaigns at Winter Olympics and in other sports. So I never shied away from a challenge. So, back to your question of what made me or why did I step into this challenge? I guess I'm not afraid of a challenge. You know, what's the worst that can happen? You fail. Big deal, right? And that's my biggest message to anyone is never be afraid to take on a challenge out of fear of failure, because you will just never
Trying is a form of failure anyway.
Absolutely. You know, at the end of your life, you'll only ever regret the decisions you didn't have the courage to take, to have a go. So from my point of view, you know, I was always up for a challenge. I wasn't afraid to be on my own as an independent. A lot of people ask why as an independent versus for a party. From my point of view, I was very disillusioned with the party system. I think the process, whether it's Liberal, Labor, or even Greens, there's a conflict that happens within the party machine in terms of whether or not you can truly stay true to your values in that process. And maybe it's because as a barrister, you're an officer of the court. So at no point can you ever put the interests of a client before the integrity of the court, right? You are an officer of the court. You can never mislead the court. And that's an important distinction for me. And I was quite shocked to find out in Parliament, even under our constitution, we have no such protections. So a member of Parliament does not owe any overriding duty to the Parliament or to the Australian people, not to bring the Parliament into disrepute
or to uphold the truth.
That's a whole nother area. But
We'll come to that. Yeah.
We ultimately swear allegiance to the monarch, and that's it. There is no swearing to the Australian people. There is no upholding the constitution. There is nothing like that, which I find quite challenging coming from a legal background.
Yeah.
In what you said then, I mean, we can put a pin in quite a number of things to come back to, but the one that you finished with there about your disillusionment with the political system and the party structure system, you were the lone voice in the House of Representatives, but now you're one of a group of voices loud voices who are independents, but consistently referred to in the media as the Teals. And I'm wondering where that, in your mind, fits in a sort of a spectrum of movement, philosophy, coalition, group, and then ultimately party. Once you start to put people together under a name, you're sort of going down the road of a structure that starts to look like let's appoint a chairperson and let's have a secretary and let's have votes in a group. So you see what I mean? You're on a transitional period now that there's a group of you. How do you see that as an issue?
I guess I've got two things that come to mind. If we go back to when our parliament was first constituted, our constitution does not talk about parties. Mm. And all the rules in our parliament have evolved through convention. None of it is actually stated constitutionally. And actually, I think it was Deakin who originally was much more in favour of a whole lot of independent MPs and saw party politics as a corruption of, you know, the values of MPs truly coming to the chamber for a place of debate to collectively get behind what might be best for the nation from a policy point of view. So then I look at the crossbench has grown to a record size. And if I think of the Teals, that, I mean, that is ultimately a brand the media appointed to us because it's too difficult to talk about community independence. And I think everyone accepts there's probably seven of us, being the seven female MPs in the crossbench. You have other members of the crossbench, but I don't think anyone sort of talks of Helen or Rebecca as a Teal.
Or Di even.
Or Di, for example. Well, actually, Di has a political party that specifically says non-Teal. ideology. Anyway, I digress. But look, the media likes the safety of what it knows, right, in looking at our political system. So it will always revert back to it likes the duopoly. It likes the idea that there is a coalition versus Labor and that there will be a sharing of power, taking turns around power, for example. People don't generally like the complexity of more competition and change. And so there's a resistance towards that, which is always interesting when you come up to the discussion of might there be a minority government. So if no side of politics can form majority outright, they are going to have to collaborate and form a coalition of the willing, or they're going to have to find a consensus around. It's always interesting how that gets talked about. People look at that as being a bad thing or a disruptive thing. But if you go back and look at history, more often than not, the heavier disruption comes from within party structures.
Yes.
The political coups, the leadership challenges come within party structures, not in minority government collaborations.
Especially when they're rather safe and assured of their position. The bigger the majority, the more likely they are to get bolshy internally.
The more outrageous the behaviour.
Yeah. Yeah.
So ironically, with the growth of the crossbench, the media is always quick to sort of do tags of this, it's going to be chaotic and goodness gracious, you're going to have to negotiate with all these people and you're going to have to brief all these people. So one area I think us Teals or us independents, we're very focused on being productive, on being collaborative. We do share many similar values, but not always land in the same way on particular policy areas. So we don't always vote the same, but we are very, I think, united around being collaborative, being effective, and, you know, being focused on good policy and really
being constructive,
constructive and challenging the government. So I would say we are the best of a potential, you know, if we want to talk at a coalition or an alliance or something like that, without the downside, which is the what happens behind the scenes, you know, the power play around pre-selections, around who's going to get tapped on the shoulder, who's not, who gets a go. And that was something that really drove me to run as an independent. I did not want to be beholden to behind the scenes shady characters that pulled the strings but didn't have to put themselves on the line. I was happy to be judged by my community and no one else.
So in the context of a minority government, which we've been close to and maybe get, will you sit down together? Would you see yourself having a sort of caucus to sit down and work out where you would vote as a bloc, or would you be likely to have splits in who to support to create a majority on the floor of the House?
Well, look, I can only speak for myself. I can't speak for others. But I think it's more a question of looking at process rather than outcome. So we, for example, already as a crossbench, and we're talking the large crossbench, so the Senate crossbench and the House crossbench, all the way from One Nation to Lydia Thorpe to the Greens to Teals to Helen, like the entire, we meet regularly to discuss to go through the business of the parliament so that we are not all across purposes. It's not about how's anyone going to vote. That's entirely up to every person. But it's about there's no point on two of us moving the same amendments. There's no point on the government having to do 10 different briefings when they can do one briefing to all of us in the room together and we then can share our concerns or questions about it. So it's about being constructive without being restrictive on each of us on how we approach things. So in the event of minority government, and I should say, you know, it gives the opportunity for the power of balance by having to come to the table. And, you know, as a barrister, I had obviously attended a lot of mediation. And the beauty about mediation is that everyone has to come to the table with goodwill, a willingness to compromise on their position to get a outcome. And I think that's how we will get better government better policy outcomes for the good of a broader part of the population in that event. So I would anticipate a willingness for us all to discuss process, the basis on which things will happen. I can't speak for others how they may want to approach it, but that would be what I would put forward to the crossbench, that a sound process of engaging with the situation collectively will be more constructive for the nation.
All right, let's just take a quick break there and be back in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When the wind veered, the smoke was driven backwards, revealing a most amazing scene. Standing columns of fire.
To Be Continued is a new podcast that explores the rich world of lost literary fiction from Australia's past.
It helps you to understand the way in which knowledge is kind of not something that's out there waiting to be discovered, but it's something that you create.
To Be Continued is brought to you by the Australian National University and is available now on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back. We're talking with Zali Steger. I'm joined by my friend and colleague, Professor Paul Pickering. Zali, just before the break, Paul was asking you about, I guess, the thorny question of minority parliament, a minority parliament in which both sides perhaps have aspirations to form a government and would seek to court the crossbench to make up a majority in the lower house. You talked about, I think, very interestingly about the process, the philosophy that you bring and some of the practicalities that you as a group bring to dealing with the government, dealing with legislation, which I found very encouraging, I must say, just because it's so sensible and practical. And as you say, not binding on any individual. But were you faced with that circumstance, as a lot of people have predicted, myself included, that, you know, Labor's in a stronger position than the coalition, if you look at the polls. We haven't had a one-term government in this country federally since 1931, I think it was, 32 maybe, a long time ago, nearly 100 years. You'd say, yes, Labor's in a stronger position, and because of the success of the Teals at the last election, it seems a much harder task for Peter Dutton's coalition to get there, to get to that 76 seats. Now, I'm not asking you to sort of say what your position is, but I'm very happy if you do, but or what the position of others would be. But it would present you with suddenly a quite significant problem about how you are all actually going to vote, whether you would agree to lend your support to the Labor Party, for example, for a majority. How would you go about that?
Well, I think what would be interesting is you would get to a situation where the bills that make it to the floor of Parliament have been genuinely panel beaten, right? There would be a situation where legislation has had proper consultation, proper exposure drafts. There would be a willingness to consider concerns, to amend where necessary, so that when it ultimately makes it to the floor of Parliament, you genuinely have good legislation.
I think that's right. I think it's absolutely right. But before you even get to that, you're going to have to have guaranteed supply and confidence.
Sure. And I think that, again, with, you know, not having a crystal ball, I think I've been quite clear since 2019, ultimately I'm here to represent my community, so I have to be true to the values and issues my community's asking me to consider and prioritise.
So policy would be a very strong determinant of policy, where you landed.
Absolutely. And also I don't believe in a one-size-fits-all approach. And so whilst, yes, a side would need to form government, that doesn't mean blanket support for all approaches to legislation. And so I think it's a little bit like it's accepting that the status quo of politics can change, and I would argue has changed over the course of the last two elections. And you only have to look at the primary vote. Only a third of Australians now, primary vote is for independents or minor parties. And then, so it's about a 30-33-33.
Yeah, like it's quite
a split. So major parties' primary vote is falling. You see it just recently with the Tasmanian election, still the situation. 99.5% of the population do not belong to political parties, right? So voters are looking for the issues and values come election time. And so it becomes a more competitive field. And like in business, a more competitive field means everyone has to up their game.
Yeah.
And you have to come to the table with genuine propositions and policy outcomes that are going to be good rather than just ideology or power for the sake of power. So I have zero interest in any side of politics that is in it just for the sake of power.
So just picking up on that point, so when I grew up in the heart of the northern suburbs of Melbourne, if I crossed the Yarra, I hit my head on the class barrier because there was a real strong correlation between economic and social policy. What you represent as the first breakthrough in that sense is this split between attitudes to social issues and economic policy that was reflected in the outcome of the Republican referendum and again in the plebiscite for gay marriage and also in the yes vote. And I think we could say that that is consistent with a sort of a syndrome of issues. Do you think there's a fundamental ideological break? I think green issues is obviously one of the key ones. Have we come to a point where the ideology of the parties no longer works?
I do think there's probably a separate question of who the parties now represent and who does their ideology speak to is a real question that they need to engage with themselves. I would come back to values and approach to policy, that the party system has entrenched a certain arrogance around values and positions that is out of step with communities. Communities are more caring about the outcomes than where the parties are at. In our traditional seats, being traditional liberal seats, it's also, we're talking about seats that are very business forward, aspirational, early adopters of technology. And so this idea now that the Liberal Party at federal level is so far right and so conservative, it is nearly anti-new technology, which is, I would say, completely at odds and at complete opposites with the idea of a competitive liberal democracy market where there is opportunity to succeed in business or enterprise or innovation. And so you've got this complete disconnect as to this holding on to the past and old technologies, refusing to acknowledge the future. And then that intermingles with social issues, you know, whether it's treatment of refugees, the same-sex plebiscite. But strangely enough, then we get to climate policy and approach to lots of other things.
Suddenly they've got some technology there, though, nuclear.
Well, again, I don't know if that's such a future-focused progressive technology as really one from the past.
Yes, yes. It's been in the past for a long time and not been adopted by anyone serious up until now. So it seems like a pretty heroic sort of
I guess the only thing
punt.
I would say is, in particular for my community, we have CEOs, heads of businesses, people that are used to a competitive environment where they know the decisions they make will impact the viability of their business. For them to be successful in an international field, they need to be on the cutting edge. They need to take on board feedback. They need to be on, you know, factual basis for things. And that is a disconnect with where the conservative side of politics are at when it comes to the facts of certain technologies. I mean, you bring up nuclear, you know, the facts are simply there in terms of timeline and cost. Mm. And rather than acknowledge that and move on to something that makes more sense from a competitive business point of view, it's this insistence that ideology should override sound business.
It's a really good example, isn't it? I mean, it's like almost the perfect example of what you've both been talking about, this triumph of ideology over sound policy thinking, sound analytical thinking about where they should be, because they've spent so long denying climate change, denying the process, frustrating it at every turn. We saw Scott Morrison brandishing a lump of coal saying, don't be afraid, and so forth. And finally, he had to be dragged kicking and screaming to just say net zero by 2050, which is, you know, decades away. And yet it was so hard for them to do. And of course, the Nats resented it. And that seemed to be driving a lot of policy in the coalition anyway. And what do they come up with now to not embrace what is the obvious thing you have to embrace once you've gone to net zero by 2050? They come up with nuclear. And they've gone in the space of the period of time between raising that as an option and not even yet to the point of announcing their policy. They've gone from small modular reactors, of which there are no practical working examples, to now large nuclear reactors that would be located on the sites of coal-fired power stations, which presumably have to keep going up until that time. It just seems like anything but actually admit that this climate challenge needs to be addressed now and needs to be addressed with progressive policy and with evidence-based policy.
Well, also that renewable technology is here to stay.
Yeah.
But I guess this brings us back full circle to one of your first questions, which was the idea that we are non-politician politicians in the sense that I've had three careers so far. Who knows what the fourth one will be? but we've come to this role to represent our communities. And when I say we, I guess I'm thinking of the TEALs, the seven professional women, in that we've come with established professional careers. We've had a level of success in those careers. We've proved an ability to persevere, to work hard, to, be analytical, to do all the things necessary to succeed to a certain level in those careers. And we bring that professionalism and capability to our roles representing our communities. And maybe getting back to, the comments you were saying from Malcolm Turnbull is, I do agree with that politics traditionally was about people who have reached a certain stage in life, have reached a certain level of capability and professional capacity to give back to their communities by representing them in Parliament from a decision-making point of view. Now, I do put a little caveat on that in that we also do need youth voices and you need to be able to have policy that reflects everyone in communities. And I know there's class divides and there's opportunity divides, and especially from a gender equity and a generational equity, that can be difficult. But traditionally, politics was about professionals who have achieved a certain level of success in life, proven their worth in a field, and come and put that to the benefit of the nation by being in Parliament. And instead, over the last 20 years, we've had this rise of the advisor,
professional
politician as a career. Mm. And I think, whilst there are some that are very good, you certainly would not want a majority of Parliament made up of people that have only had that career pathway, because they just do not have the life experience outside.
Yeah, I mean, they've sort of mixed in a sense with other people who are deeply politically engaged. Mm. They socialise with them and so forth. I mean, as you say, some of them, these people have turned out to be extraordinarily effective politicians, bright, imaginative in some of their policy, really great in detail and great communicators as well. But you don't want that as a cohort. You don't want that as your dominant cohort because, as you say, it's a, sort of a recipe for drifting away from the community. It's meant to be the House of Representatives. That actually means something.
That does mean something. And also, especially in this day and age where so much of our thinking is very siloed, if you look at especially younger generations, everyone getting so much information through social media, it's bite-sized, and we know the algorithms work in ways that people's views are reinforced by silos of information that is sort of provided that reinforces people's perceptions. Yes. And so there's a danger then that we've all get into very limited areas of thinking. And the beauty, if I go back to my experiences, the beauty about going to a mediation is you've all got to sit around the table and you've got to listen to everyone's perspective and find your common ground, right? You've got to find your grey in the middle. And that can be difficult, but I think ultimately that's how you get outcomes.
Now, we're going to have to get you back at some point because there's so much to talk about. In the few minutes we've got left in this podcast, I wonder if we could just focus on a couple of the issues that you're particularly pushing this term. Things like, issues that you've spoken about before, donations, campaign financing, as it's often described, truth in advertising, these sorts of issues. Can you speak about them and any other issues that you would like to make serious inroads into in this term?
Absolutely. I mean, we've definitely been pushing for electoral reform to try and ensure a more transparency and more accountability so that when, constituents and people go to the polls and they vote, they're equipped with information. So again, as coming from my legal background, I was shocked in 2019 to find out that whilst we have Australian consumer law to protect consumers from scams, so if you are going to part with your money to pay for a service or buy a product, you can't be scammed with misleading and deceptive advertising about those things, or that is illegal. But in the political context, there is no equivalent legislation to outlaw misleading and deceptive political advertising. There's just no requirement under the AEC. So I was quite shocked about that. That says as a society, we value our consumer rights higher. We protect them higher than our voting rights. And that's just fundamentally wrong. And actually, all polling suggests that voters of all persuasion across a number of issues, whether it's elections or the referendum, and whether they were yes or no voters, absolutely support truth in political advertising. They feel that there should be a standard, and we should be able to outlaw misleading and deceptive or incomplete statements of fact, which is really important.
And would that apply to candidates and their parties and beyond that to third parties? Because, of course, third parties, we saw Advance recently in the Dunkley by-election. We saw it in the Voice campaign. We've seen Get Up on the left running third-party campaigns. We know, of course, the action committees in the US, they're a way around electoral laws there. So how do you address that? And, of course, we're going into an area of increasing AI as well where the sort of provenance of some information is very difficult to establish?
Absolutely. So the legislation is mirrored off the legislation in South Australia. It applies to electoral matters, so paid advertising that is authorised for the purpose of an election and it has with a political matter. It applies to candidates and third-party organisations, so it applies to that broad reach. And it does apply to deepfakes. So we are in an era with AI where we can see deepfakes is where, obviously, I'm a person in the public domain. You could find a whole heap of recordings of things I've said on the record. A computer can put that together into a message that is completely inconsistent with my policy platform or my values and pump that out in a paid way to a certain audience to get them to feel a certain way about me. Now, that should be outlawed. So it's as soon as there is that payment to reach a certain audience that is considered advertising, right? Mm-hmm. It's a promotional aspect and it should be regulated in that way. Look, the good thing, I've presented a number of bills to that effect. The government is inclined to do it. They're working through the technicalities of it. Obviously, the Australian Electoral Commissioner is reluctant to have the responsibility, so I think an independent body or department needs to be worked out.
And you're dealing with Don Farrell on this, the minister?
Dealing with the minister on that. And look, I welcome Peter Dutton indicated that the opposition would look at it as well because their voters support it as well. So I think it's really important for everyone to realise voters do not want to be lied to. They want to be equipped with facts and they will then make up their mind. So that's positive.
Sorry to dwell on this, but would, for example, what happened on election day last time when the Liberal Party sent out those text messages in relation to a boat that had arrived on shore, and would that be captured by this law?
Well, I don't know that one would qualify as advertising. It's more the question of, I mean, the big campaigns we've seen was sort of the Mediscare campaign, the death tax campaign, right?
Yeah.
From each side.
Yeah.
And there is a reason why this hasn't been done before. No party of government has passed this legislation before. Ultimately, each side likes to take advantage of the loophole when they're in power, right?
Yeah.
We've seen it from both sides.
Yeah.
But the crossbench is very much pushing and the communities are pushing for this standard to change. What it will see is obviously the power for the commissioner or whoever is empowered to ask for immediate retraction and pull down. Obviously, like consumer law, it can go to the courts and there are serious fine implications involved and greater fines for organisations than individuals and candidates. It's also empowering the social media platforms, being able to ask them to retract it and bring the material down. But I should say the other area you touched on around the donation reform is incredibly important as well because we are seeing big money involved in politics and it does become a race to the bottom.
Mm.
And I acknowledge that. I acknowledge a huge amount of money was spent on my campaigns and many others. The difficulty is how do you come up with a fair and equitable formula that doesn't entrench incumbent advantage?
Yes.
And through incumbent advantage is also major party advantage.
Yeah, because it just locks out the prospect
of other representation. It locks out competition.
Yeah.
So I think there's some clear-cut changes that can happen, things like real-time donation disclosure. So within 7 days of a donation, you put it on the register. That means voters, by the time they go to the polls, have got a pretty fair idea of who's supporting what side, where money's coming from.
Could you do real-time 7-day declaration except in the last week where it has to happen immediately?
Well, look, again, there's
because parties would, I tell you what, parties would start getting large donations
right
in the last
the end.
Week. Yeah.
Probably, so, people will always find loopholes.
Yeah. Yeah, well, exactly. So, mixing a whole bunch of metaphors, isn't the genie already out of the bottle? And by the time you get to try and punish transgressions, the government's already decided. There's a whole series of ways in which it seems like it's trying to deal with a problem that's post-election rather than pre-election.
Well, the goal of more real-time disclosure is that there is greater visibility ahead of election day. And keeping in mind, most people now vote in that pre-poll period, right? Mm. It's spread out over 2 to 3 weeks. It's not a situation of everyone just coming on one day to vote. And so I think better accountability leading up to that election period is important. I mean, at the moment, we have a double standard system where independents reveal their finances, have to give a full account of any money received and spent in about November after the May election. The parties don't reveal what they received or spent until February the following year, so some 4 months after the independents, and don't have to give a breakdown per seat. So it's just this big national, aggregate number.
Yeah.
So there's no identification.
In which is hiding some quite interesting and critical detail.
Massive amount. And I should say, in 21-22, there was some, I think it was 57 or $51 million of funding to the major party was unaccounted for, right? So there's clearly big gaps in the disclosure requirements and how that happens at the moment. The difficulty about putting sort of donation caps or campaign spending caps is I think it entrenches incumbent advantage. Mm-hmm. And the government is looking at it from a point of view of increase the amount of public funding for elections. So now that is not very palatable for the public. The public does not want to see more public money going to paying for elections and into the coffers of major parties. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, the counter to that then means you being able to fundraise and accumulate enough funding to run campaigns. So
it's interesting, that if we think of those two things together, that there was public funding but better integrity in politics because of the limits on the amount of misinformation that, lying and so forth that goes on in campaigns. Those two things could actually work in some sort of combination. Like people would be more happy to fund political parties if they didn't see the whole process as a grubby exaggeration fest.
Fair enough. And look, I think
with lots of grey area.
Also, the system of how the public funding is allocated is it's retrospective, right?
Yeah.
It's after the
vote.
It's based on votes from the previous election. And so if you are a newcomer to the field, a new candidate, you have no way of accessing that until after the outcome. And so that's the difficulty of relying on public funding. It is very, I think it really disadvantages any newcomers, any competition to the field. But look, I am pragmatic on this, that I think just because it's difficult doesn't mean we shouldn't try and tackle it. I don't think we can fix it all at once, but I think we can do meaningful reform now to start moving the dial on the accountability and transparency of elections. But I do think around misleading and deceptive information, it's really urgent. Well, we've seen this sort of this rise of misinformation and disinformation, and we know we currently have through social media platforms information is disseminated in a very targeted way. You can target your audience in a very specific way, and it can be spread very quickly. And so if we have no requirements around misleading and deceptive content, we really, I think, will face major problems because it becomes self-reinforcing. But I should say for anyone listening, this is not about controlling freedom of speech, right? People get very worked up on the idea that this is controlling truth. This is not. People can express opinions all the time. This will not capture opinions. What it captures is statements of facts or attributed to someone else that are not correct. Yeah. So I would say to people, when you buy a vacuum cleaner, and if that vacuum cleaner manufacturer made an outrageous claim in its advertising, right, that this would be just revolutionary, you do not go and say to the courts, well, that's banning that advertising because it's misleading and deceptive is not an attack on the freedom of speech of that manufacturer, right? Because they are scamming a consumer. Yeah. And so the same applies in politics. This is not an attack on freedom of speech, freedom of opinions, all of that is absolutely available. But you cannot mislead and deceptive as to statements of fact in paid advertising, which is targeted to specific audiences.
So a lot of what Clive Palmer did at the recent elections would be picked up by that because there's just, you know, the billboards everywhere. And
I think some of the claims he were making were possibly, and again, it's that distinction between you can say, in my opinion, their policy will achieve this mm-hmm. as opposed to their policy is X, right? Yeah. They are two very different things.
Yeah.
And I think it's a distinction that's important.
Yeah, absolutely. We're out of time. It's been really terrific talking to you. More power to your arm with those negotiations. And if, as you say, you do some of these things on electoral reform, truth and advertising, donations and so forth now, and you might not be able to do everything that you want to do, but you may find yourself in a quite pivotal position after the next election, and that might be a very worthwhile thing to break that habit of the political party in power not really wanting to, you know, reform electoral system.
Become the speaker. Organise, well, better rule the chamber.
I would argue we've certainly got a long list when it comes to reforms to question time.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear it. Having sat
that's
through
where I was going next, but we've got another half an hour.
As a former barrister, the deep desire to ask follow-up questions is very hard.
Yeah,
or to hold people to a point of relevance.
Yeah,
point to of genuinely get be rid relevant of Dorothy to a Dixer. Question.
Get rid of the Dorothy Dixer altogether, I would say. Thanks, Ali Steggel. It's been terrific talking to you. It's been an overdue interview, and I'm really glad that you had time to come and see us today and have a chat, and we look forward to expanding on some of these issues in the future.
Thank you.
Thanks to you as well, Paul.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's been really fun.
That's Democracy Sausage for this week. Talk to you again next week. Bye for now.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.